WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2013 interview with author Jonathan Lethem. His novel, Dissident Gardens, about three generations of one family, is now out in paperback. In the story, the grandmother is a secular Jew and a communist. Her daughter moves to Greenwich Village and marries a folk singer. They live in a commune where they raise their son. The grandmother and mother are inspired by Lethem's own grandmother and mother. When we left off, the author and Terry were talking about the similarities between Lethem's life and the son who was raised on the commune.
From one of your personal essays, I got the impression you were exposed to naked bodies around the home because it was a period when people were trying to be very comfortable about their bodies.
All the time.
And yeah. So I always wonder, what was it like for the kids who grew up that way, and how did it affect your sense of your comfort with your own body?
Well, just as I said that, you know, I kind of believe that, strictly speaking, we weren't a commune. I think we pretty much were a commune. You shouldn't overlook the human ability to partition things and make special categories and, you know, create exemptions. You know, this is, I guess, what we also call hypocrisy, right? Which is, as you pointed out, all over this book. But for me, there were the typical teenage fascinations with the mysteries of the bodies of the girls I was going to school with, you know, where to glimpse a bra strap might have blown my mind. And at the same time, I'd go home and I'd go up to my dad's studio and I might sit there with him and draw from a naked model for a few hours. But that was, you know, that was art. That was another thing. Or I might take a shower with my cousin at her commune because they had a group shower and, you know, that was interesting to me too, and probably titillating, but I kept these things very, very tightly organized in order to function. So I, you know, each thing was its own separate reality.
Something else that you were exposed to in ways that you probably didn't necessarily know at the time, you write again in a personal essay that your parents had an open marriage and that you later learned that some of their friends were actually their lovers. And one of the characters in your book says, is anything more unforgivable than what a child learns about his parents from their lovers? Were you ever in that position?
Well, yeah. I mean, and this isn't directly part of this book or my other, you know, kind of autobiographical, emotional slag heap, The Fortress of Solitude. But I learned the fact that my mother was dying, not that she was sick, not that she was very sick, but that she was absolutely going to die, not from either one of my parents, but from my father's girlfriend at the time. And now this is a mistake, right? I mean, everyone involved is making some mistake. They've overlooked something. Probably my father thought I knew and understood already. But I, as I've just said, children are literal. I kept it in a box. If she was sick, she was sick. That's different from dying or dead. But the first time it was told to me clearly, so that I couldn't evade it or mistake it for some other information, it was my father's girlfriend. And
did she know that you didn't know?
I don't think she went into that situation thinking she was making a big move. I think she just said it. And maybe by the end of the encounter, she grasped that she'd ended up telling me. Not a good moment for anyone involved. And yeah, I mean, there, you know, if I want to feel angry, I still know that person and am affectionate. I feel affectionately toward them. But if I want to feel angry, I could remember that moment and I'd probably be able to get angry for the rest of my life.
As you mentioned, your mother died of a brain tumor. And in one of your personal essays, you wrote that, you know, in part because of the Holocaust, you were taught to be prepared to lose the things you love. And that when your mother died, you'd experienced it as kind of confirmation that you should be prepared for that because your mother was taken from you.
Yeah, I think my parents' attitude towards the visionary world that they wanted to live in, it was an embattled one. And my grandmother's attitude towards, I think, her visionary beliefs, her idealism, was that of someone who'd been betrayed. And that the Holocaust meant that as Jews, even if we didn't care for that identity, you know, and my father was from the Midwest. I was raised with a whole lot of options as to you know, what I should identify as or with. But at the same time, there was this message, this contradictory message that my grandmother would almost whisper this. It was really one of the most doomy things to say to a kid. She would say, it doesn't matter what you think you are. When the Nazis come, you're a Jew. You know, like, they're going to pin that yellow star on you. So it doesn't matter that you're going to Quaker Sunday school or that you don't believe in God or that I don't believe in God. We're stuck with this. And I also think that this was the city I was living in. New York City in the 70s was a collapsing zone. It was a dystopian city. The greatness, you know, that my parents both celebrated, they'd come to New York for its bohemian culture. My father was a painter. What do? You run away from the provinces to New York. My grandmother revered New York, but at the same time, this place was unmistakably in crisis. It might not be as great as it once was, and the neighborhood we were in exemplified this crisis. So I saw the idea that great things about your family or your world or your city or your community or your beliefs could be, before you even knew it, they could be slipping away, they could be taken away. It seemed to me to be the message that the world had all over the place. And I celebrated temporary utopia. My family was great while it was great, and it fell apart.
Your mother knew she was dying. Did she give any instructions about what she wanted to done with her remains and if she wanted any kind of funeral or memorial?
Well, I'm sure that my parents discussed this. I've never even thought to force my father to rehearse the details for me. But she ended up having two services, one very embracing and large at the Brooklyn Quaker Meeting House. And it was where all her friends, in the manner of a Quaker service, stood and testified about her importance to their lives. And it was the one that reflected her, the life she'd chosen. Even though she hadn't chosen Quakerism, she wasn't terrifically interested in Quakerism. She didn't go with us. My father took the kids to Quaker Sunday school, and my mother was too secular even for the Quakers. But still, this was the place where she could have, you know, what I guess you'd call a hippie funeral in a sense. It was a love-in as funerals go. And then she also, and this this will remind you of my grandmother's insistence that my parents be married by a rabbi rather than the Reverend Gary Davis, she also had a very dark, very cloistered, very small Upper West Side Jewish service in a funeral home. And my grandmother, my great-grandmother, my great-uncle, who I think I'd not met until that day and never met again on my mother's father's side, were in attendance, and it was, the children were put in yarmulkes, and we went through the paces of giving her the proper Jewish memorial that she couldn't have possibly demanded, but somebody did, probably my grandmother.
So you were 14. What did you walk away with having seen these two completely different ways of marking your mother's life and mourning her death?
Well, I wasn't conjugating these things at the time. I was looking for an exit from the scene. My primary response to losing her was to decide to kind of graduate myself to adulthood, to move sideways out of my family into the world of my friendships and my interests and a handful of very warm and wonderful young adult friends.
Having grown up with two generations of people who believed in causes and were committed to causes, communism in your grandmother's life, and you know, like the anti-war movement. Did you have any commitment to political causes, or did you separate from the world of causes and head more in another direction?
I don't know. I'm pretty incoherent, and I think about identify with a political life without, I think, successfully living one.
Which is in opposition to the certitude that your family had.
Yeah. I mean, but the belief that you're making a kind of systematic and coherent political life is much easier to sustain, even for my parents and their generation. I don't mean that critically. And as well for my grandmother, who was, you know, on close inspection, incoherent as well, even if she had a lot more of a sensation of righteousness than I can get away with day to day.
You gave a commencement address at Bennington College, and I forget what year this was, how recently it was, but you mentioned the first advice that was given to you that really mattered to you, and it was a phrase from what you describe as like hippie-era Buddhism. And the phrase was, all paths lead nowhere, choose one with heart. It's actually pretty good. And
yeah, I still like it.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about why that works
well,
for you?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, I was giving a commencement address to a college where I dropped out. And, you know, I hadn't dropped out of Princeton or MIT. I dropped out of the most kind of forgiving, hippie, experimental college, right? One of the places that defines that kind of school experience. And even there, I couldn't make it work. I was too at odds with institutions and too angry about various things to function as a college student. So here I was circling back, and it was a moment of healing for me, but a very confusing one. You know, you go through life having these crossroads, these reactions, where you basically, you know, in retrospect, what I said was, you can't fire me, I quit. I was afraid of what I was faced with at Bennington College. And here I was, I'd kind of made it all good. You know, it's a victory lap. Give the commencement address. And I wanted to make it better for myself in front of them that I was giving them such a strange, that in my own life was such a strange allegory of disappointment and satisfaction, of, you know, exile and return, that here I was consecrating their capacity to do 4 years of college that I couldn't handle myself. But I did feel that in one sense or another, I'd come back there and discovered that I'd honored the spirit of the place anyway. And I was in pretty good faith giving them advice. If the advice was all paths lead nowhere, choose one with heart. Because what I'd done when I left Bennington was, you know, my courage didn't fail me then. I sought out other kinds of mentorship and experience, and I was an autodidact, and I was fearless about writing, even though I had very few people encouraging me to write for a while. And so in a way, I'd had my cake and eaten it too.
Jonathan Leatham, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Such a good time for me. Thank you, Terry.
Author Jonathan Leatham speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. His novel, Dissident Gardens, is now out in paperback. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Late Late Show. I'm going into my act. This is my last set, so you don't know what's going to happen.
In the 1960s, jazz pianist Jackie Byard played in the bands of Charles Mingus, Rahsaan Roland Kirk, and Booker Irvin. Then he began making solo and small band records under his own name. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Byard had a rare ability to sound both archaic and ahead of his time.
Jackie Byard, turning Dave Brubeck's sprightly tune In Your Own Sweet Way into something heavy as a Russian novel. It's from Byard's album The Late Show, a set of previously unheard solo music from San Francisco's Keystone Corner in 1979. Byard was always a kidder at the keyboard. He'd take a familiar tune, turn it inside out, or goose it till it jumped. Jackie Byard having his way with Sweet Georgia Brown. Byard was more than a musical comedian. He was a throwback to early jazz piano professors like James P. Johnson and Willie the Lion Smith, who took pride in their erudition and formidable technique, who could make any material their own and have fun doing it. Those old-timers were masters of stride piano, the post-ragtime style where a player's left hand ping-pongs up and down the keyboard. Byard was the rare post-bebop pianist, well-versed in stride style. You can hear a little of Crazy Cat Earl Hines in Jackie Byard's timing and suspenseful dropouts. Playing stride piano was no gimmick for Byard. It was part of the arsenal of techniques and styles on call whenever he sat at the keys. A modernist who valued the innovations of any age, Byard could play new and old ideas at the same time. Jackie Byard had developed his pan-historical approach by 1960. No one called it postmodern jazz then, but his deadpan juxtaposition of diverse styles and song fragments helped point the way. There's some old-school showbiz shtick in there, too, with roots in the musical travelogues that 19th-century theater bands would play. Byard's European episode moves like a brisk bus tour, shunting you from an English country garden to old Vienna. Sometimes it sounds like he can barely keep up with the pace. I'm not partial to live albums that leave in the stage announcements, but Jackie Byard's are funnier than most, part of his whole nutty professor act. We get a few little tastes.
As I said, I don't have to do this for a living because I have two chinchillas in heat, and that affords me a nice little living.
These days, many jazz pianists demonstrate familiarity with multiple styles, stride piano included. Partly that's because some of them studied with Jackie Byard. Maybe because he was 30 years ahead of his time, Byard hasn't quite gotten his due, but he left a batch of fine albums behind for smart fans to rediscover, starting with his fab trio debut Here's Jackie from 1961. No current pianist I've heard makes virtuosity sound quite so gleefully lighthearted.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Wondering Sound and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Jackie Byard, The Late Show, live at the Keystone Corner, Volume 3, on the High Note label.